Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to the podcast, New Books in Islamic Studies, a channel with the New Books Network. This is your co-host, Shahnaz Haqqani. In today's episode, we speak with Abla Hassan about her recent book, Decoding the Egalitarianism of the Quran, Retrieving Lost Voices on Gender, published with Lexington Books in 2020. In Decoding the Egalitarianism of the Quran, Hassan aims to provide new interpretations of Quranic verses related to gender and family, or at least verses believed by many others to be about the family, through a Quran-only approach. She shows that it is possible, meaningful, and necessary to read the Quran outside of any external sources such as hadiths, fiqh, or Islamic jurisprudence, tafsir, or interpretations of the Quran, and other traditional ways through which the Quran has historically been read. This allows her to offer new interpretations of many verses, such as those related to polygyny, the hijab, child marriage, the claim that men have a degree of superiority over women, and verse 434, which is traditionally believed to grant husbands the right to physically discipline their wives. Using her background in the linguistics of the Quran, she analyzes the textual context of each verse in question, as well as in specific key terms to highlight what she argues are the original intended meanings of these verses. For example, she interrogates common understandings of the audiences of many gender-related verses believed to be men or husbands, and offers alternative possibilities. The book is an important intervention in the discourse on Islam and gender, and it will be of interest to specialist and non-specialist, including non-academic audiences interested in women's and gender studies, Quranic studies, religion and gender, and tafsir studies. The book will also be of use in undergraduate and graduate classes related to gender and religion. In our discussion today, she explains her choice to rely on the Quran alone for her arguments, including the importance of a linguistic and semantic approach to understanding the scripture. She shares with us what some of the problems in existing scholarship on gender and Islam are, whether from feminist engagements or the historical patriarchal ones. And she shares some of her interpretations of some verses, such as female agency in the Quran, Maryam's prophethood, polygyny, the hijab, the idea of men's daraja or a degree of superiority over women, and of course, Quranic verse 434, among others. This is our discussion. Hi, Abla. Thank you so much for joining me today to talk about your new book, Decoding the Egalitarianism of the Quran, Retrieving Lost Voices on Gender. I thoroughly enjoyed it, so I'm very excited to be sitting here and talking with you about it today.
Thank you so much, Shahnaz. Thank you. It's an honor to be interviewed by you personally. Thank you so much.
You're very kind. I'm very much looking forward to it, as I was telling you. I'm doing a vlog on it for my What the Patriarchy vlog, where I talk about Islamic feminist arguments and works on Islamic feminism, the idea of mainstreaming Islamic feminism. So I'm really, really looking forward to it, because there were a lot of arguments in here and interpretations that I hadn't thought about myself and that I haven't seen elsewhere. So it was very innovative in that sense as well. So thank you for it.
Thank you so much. And let me start by acknowledging I'm personally a big fan of your channel as well. I got introduced to it very late, But, you know, I fall in love with it immediately. And I was so excited when you emailed me first asking for this interview, because I'm a big fan of your views and the channel and the whole idea of trying to, you know, to find and to locate this true Islam, which we all keep talking about, but we're finding hardship into identifying. So thank you, Shehnaz, for all what you do. Let me start by saying this.
I appreciate that. Thank you so much. So let's begin with, we have a tradition on this podcast to ask our guests to tell us about their journey to the field. What brought you here?
I graduated in 2013 with a PhD in philosophy of language. My BA was in philosophy from Damascus University back in Syria, and my master's degree was in philosophy as well from Nebraska University. And I believe it was my training with my advisor, my great advisor, Professor Edward Becker, who's a professor of philosophy of language and our UNL expert on philosophy of religion, which led me to Quranic hermeneutics. Because the idea, I believe, is very simple: to decode the Quranic message and to locate this missing true Islam. We were just mentioning trying to find a true Islam. I believe all what we need to do is to go back to the original text. It's all there. It's all embodied in the text, which we need to give a second chance instead of satisfying by referring back to it in a retrospective way. Now, while my training with my advisor was not on Quranic studies per se, the sensitivity of to language and the deep consideration of what every sentence, word, and even every letter refer to is something I think I got from my advisor. My advisor was generous enough to meet with me once a week, sometimes for extended hours. And he used to stop me sometimes for every word I would say to double check what I mean and whether I was referring to events or types of events, et cetera, et cetera. You know, Shehnaz, I imagine him laughing to hear my words. I remember, like, sometimes when he kept, you know, picking on everything I say, I was like, come on, it's not even my native language here. But gradually, I started paying attention to what we really mean when we say things, references, names, synonyms, repetition. Almost all aspects of each language, all details, the delicate details, which we almost never pay attention to, at the end of the day, they might be the key to set us free from our man-made projections and take us back to the authentic message of the divine text. We were just mentioning this before the interview, and I'm going to be quoting you. You emailed me back after you read the book, and you said, I'm struck by some of your interpretations that are so new and innovative. And now that I think about it, even obvious that I can't believe we've been missing all along, which is very true, Shehnaz. It's just there in the text. It's as simple as that. We just need to give the text a second chance by being more careful to the language. So this is, in short, what brought me to Quranic hermeneutics.
Mm-hmm. No, and it shows the training that you have and your advisor playing this role in your life by sort of stopping you and saying, what do you mean? And is that the correct language? Is that the correct word to convey your meaning? That was very clear throughout the book. And for me, one of the most striking things was this idea of the Quran's audience, which I think we'll talk about, you know, where we've just assumed, we've accepted historical interpretations and assumptions that we know who the Quran's audience is in a particular verse when, you know, I think very few of us have ever even, and certainly your book made that very clear, that we haven't tried to interrogate the assumption itself that there's a particular audience and that audience is necessarily meant. So, the emphasis on language and the focus on specific words and the ways the Quran is making that point all showed very clearly throughout the book. So thank you for that. Mm-hmm. Do you want to talk specifically about the journey of this book and maybe its broader relationship with, you know, existing ideas that also must have given birth to this?
Sure. I can briefly comment on that. It's very simple. The book is simply an attempt to allow the Quran to speak for itself. Now, I'm not claiming I'm providing more than my own interpretations of women-related verses, but allowing the text to speak and muting the distraction from other resources, which I propose as a thought experiment and as a research methodology that doesn't negate other methodologies but complements them, led me to address some of the most controversial verses like in the Quran, like the famous 434, and some of the most debated topics like women prophethood, which can be easily proven to be Quranic. So in short, this book is an attempt to provide, to propose some answers to some convoluted and thorny questions, especially after traditionalists' attempts to address these issues. And I'm sad to say that they didn't take us anywhere. I mean, if we just consider, for example, until when are we supposed to keep debating issues like minor marriage, for example, while the whole issue was resolved, as I argue in this book in Quran 4:6, chapter 4, verse 6, which explicitly define the age of marriage as the age which one can make sound judgments. Through my career as a teacher and through my talks, I get so many questions. So this book is an honest attempt to answer these questions. And to be more honest, it's an attempt to answer my own questions before I go ahead and answer others' questions. This is a little bit off topic, Jahnaz, but I remember I have three boys, and I remember the first time I handed Zane, who's a teenager, he does debate and he's very sharp, a translation of the Quran as a gift during Ramadan. And it took him only half an hour to come back to me and to say, to refer to 434 and say, "Mom, what is this?"
Wow.
And you know, I was like, Zane, I have, you know, a response. Wait until my book gets published first. I'm going to get back to you with something. So the idea, you know, as parents, as educators, we need to have answers. Traditional answers stopped working a long time ago. And the approach, you know, of have a faith and you'll stop questioning, because I have a faith, I'll keep questioning, you know. So basically, it's a questioning everything in this book and an attempt to answer some of these questions.
One of the reasons I loved, and I think this whole project in general, the broader project of Islamic feminism and feminist approaches to understanding the Quran, is that it just shows how complicated scriptures can be and how what an impact historical any one interpretation can have on people's actual lives. And just today, actually, I was trying to make this point in a class of mine where we were talking about evolution and scripture and how people try to make sense of or find meaning in scriptures, utilizing new contexts and new questions and new theories and stuff to really to try to make sense of these scriptures. And so this project, this larger project of feminist interpretations, I mean, I've become, and especially recently, I think I was having a conversation with, I want to say maybe Keisha Ali, and she pointed out to me that she too, I think it was her, but she was also pointing out that all of these are efforts, all of these are attempts to really better understand the Quran. And that for me, that conversation was so powerful because I was like, wait a minute, I finally began to understand the whole project and the whole idea of interpretations. And these are all efforts. And in my opinion, important and beautiful efforts. And they really, you know, they do something to the text and they do something to a person's relationship with, in this case, with our faiths as well. So absolutely very, very great project to be contributing to. You're very clear throughout the book that you're using only the Quran to make these new arguments. And in other words, you're doing a tafsir al-Quran bil-Quran, a tafsir of the Quran through the Quran itself alone. Why do you do this? And I wonder also if it's really even possible to complete such a task successfully, given that, in my opinion anyway, This methodology, I think, assumes that the text of the Quran is very clear, and also that we still end up relying on non-Quranic sources, such as socio-historical contexts of some of the verses. So can you clarify to our reader, to our readers and listeners, what an interpretation of the Quran using just the Quran means exactly?
Sure. I'm going to try to do my best. I know I won't be able to provide a good answer in an interview, but I'm going to start by referring to an interesting scene depicted in the Quran of the prophet complaining in the Day of Judgment by saying, "Lord, my people treat this Quran as something to be shunned." And this is from Quran 25:30. And by the way, this is the verse I opened the book with. Now, this accusation of leaving the Quran behind is not compatible with our experience of the Quran, which is celebrated in the lived experiences of all Muslims around the globe. But a closer look at the Quranic teachings and the way they were just overlooked in interpretation and the everyday practice, I think should motivate us to rethink the text. I adopt a strict application of tafsir al-Quran bil-Quran, which might sound challenging, I agree, and almost impossible. But however, you know, such a methodology, which only sounds impossible and difficult, on the long run can save us time and effort. Time and effort that otherwise will be just made to reconcile the Quranic message and the later exegetical development, or efforts to reconcile different elements of Sirah which don't add up, or even efforts to reconcile Hadith with Quran, or even contradicting Hadith. This methodology, and this is my personal view, is more consistent than cherry-picking and selective methodologies many of us are forced to adopt in Quranic studies due to the embarrassment some elements bring us. Let me use an example here. For example, many reformers and feminists quote only what seems to be more consistent with a more bright image of Islam, and to try to leave behind or shovel under the rug what can't serve their needs. Personally, I disagree with this approach. So either we share everything, or you take a different route, which the thing I did in my research in this book and inshallah in coming books. What adds to this is the globalization of knowledge and the accessibility of information, which don't allow such outdated techniques. Nowadays, as I always tell my students, you can check the credibility of what I'm saying the same minute I'm saying it. You can Google what I'm citing and what I'm leaving behind intentionally or subconsciously before I end my quote. So appealing to no authority but the Quran, I believe, sets you free from the moral, academic, and epistemic obligation to deal with later exegetical development that didn't stay faithful to the Quranic message. I totally see your concern, and I see it as a valid concern. It's a valid question. Can the Quran be the key to unlock the Quranic message? Now, to be clear, if we appeal to what we've been taught, the Quran is a difficult book to understand, and the only way to understand it is the way that goes through the scrutiny of imams, clerics, congregations, religious and political authoritative institutions. However, this is not out of many reasons. This is not the case, at least, in which the Quran describes the Quran. In fact, the Quran assures it as a divine commitment to make it an accessible book. I'm quoting from 54:17. "We have made it easy to learn lessons from the Quran." And in 75:19, we read, "It's up to us to make it clear." Places in which the Quran is introduced as a coherent, clear, and consistent book are more than I can quote here. But what is important to keep in mind is the gap that we shouldn't overlook between Islam and I would say all religions as a liberal, personal, spiritual guidance, and religions as controlling institutions. Finally, I'll end with this. While I introduce a very strict application of based on opinion interpretation, I should give credit to the long history of this school, which has never agreed with the hegemony of based on heritage school, a hegemony that, unfortunately, we're still paying its high price until today.
Thank you for that. That's very, very thorough and very beautiful answer.
Thank you, Shehnaz.
So related to that question also, what are some current problems with the way that women and men are talked about in the Quran, and not just as seen in the traditional patriarchal approaches, but also as seen in Islamic feminist approaches to the Quran?
Mainly, I believe it's very problematic to keep borrowing lenses to read the Quran through. We can't, as feminists, criticize patriarchy or the political elite for prioritizing their best interest and merely replace their male-centered interpretations by female-centered interpretations. Because, Shehnaz, what we will be doing, we're going to be just doing the same mistake. Only, we're going to be only replacing what they might view today as, what we might view today as outdated ideologies with what we view as liberal and egalitarian ideologies. The text should speak for itself. For example, many feminist attempts to solve the many problems associated with the traditional interpretation of 434 couldn't stay faithful to the text itself. And therefore, in my interpretation, I don't assume any mistakes in the text. I don't add anything. I don't delete anything from the literal text itself, or I don't deviate away from what the text itself indicates. Another example is my reading of the story of Adam and Eve. Here I'm highlighting only one scene, which is the scene of Adam's disobedience. According to the many evidences I introduce, and according to the readings of other prominent scholars, it seems that the Quran blames Adam more for God's disobedience. Now, I remember I had back and forth emails with my editor as we were finalizing the book, and she was trying to suggest whether it's better to have Adam and Eve both sharing the blame. And I thought that would be cool and fine, but this is not what I read in the text. So in short, it is we should avoid doing what we've been criticizing others for doing. We should stop projecting ourselves on the text. And I would say we should be chasing and arresting ourselves every time we try to project our own ideologies on the text. We should be just honest into just reading the text and listening to the text.
Mm-hmm. That's really funny that you say that the editor wanted you to,
definitely. She was nice enough, to try to question so many points. And this was one of the points that I insisted, this is what I read and this is what I should be saying, whether, I like it or not.
Yeah. No, I use the example of the disobedience of Adam's because the Quran does. I mean, it blames either Adam alone or Shaitan or both Adam and Eve. And so I use this a lot in my classes to show that the scholars historically still somehow managed to read, that Eve was the evil one.
That's very true.
It's really, remarkable how it's absolutely remarkable because that was an existing knowledge at the time. And so it made sense that they weren't going to be way too creative with it. But, it also shows how uncreative patriarchy is. It only relies
on. I'm so happy you're mentioning that because, this is one of the main points that kept puzzling me. The text is asserting something and interpretations are not only elaborating on it, or a little bit, going into details, they're contradicting the text, just bluntly contradicting the text, which means, the text was not read carefully, either intentional or it was just an attempt to prioritize other agendas or the so many other reasons I try to explain in the book.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So speaking of interpretations of specific themes or specific points in the Quran, then I enjoyed, I mean, many of your these findings, these new readings of the women-related verses in the Quran, and we probably won't have time to get into all of them, but let's definitely cover some of them. So talk to us about the notorious 434. Mm. You offer a lot here that I think is different from and in disagreement with much existing material on 434. So can you walk us through your interpretation of it or parts of it? I'm interested in the idea of Qiwama and whether it's about all women or about wives specifically, who the audience of 434 is. And
Sure. To be honest with you, I've always had problems with 434. I still remember in a conversation with our awesome scholar, Amir Hussein, I collected my courage as if I'm revealing a big secret. And I said, I have a problem with 434. He simply said, Abla, we all have a problem with 434. You know, at that time, as simple as his answer was, coming from someone like him was a big deal. Because usually what we get as feminists is either, and I shared that with him later on, you know, either reproaching answers or preaching answers. Have a faith, sister, and you'll stop, you know, getting annoyed by these interpretations, which is the opposite. This verse is more problematic than any other verse in the Quran. In the book, I provide 20 detailed arguments in favor of a new interpretation, which I won't be able to introduce here, but I can only refer to some quick observations. Now, in its traditional, I'm assuming everyone are familiar with 434, but a quick reminder, in its traditional understanding, the verse is commonly interpreted as providing husbands three correction methods to deal with wives, their wives, that starts by reproaching, escalates to withholding sex, and ends by the permissibility of striking their wives. However, this interpretation not only contradicts the rest of the Quran, but also contradicts the prophetic behavior as well. And this speaks at least for those who insist on adding other resources other than the Quran. Attempts to soften the tune of the verse by suggesting light beating with a feather, for example, with all respect to these attempts, but they're not Quranic, right? Hitting with a feather is not hitting in the first place. It's tickling, right? And, you know, imagine if a wife complains to her husband that you're beating me, but you're not using a feather. He's going to be like, seriously, right? So with all respect to all these attempts, those attempts are not Quranic. But more seriously, the mere idea of giving one gender the right to correct the other gender due to gender-based superiority, the whole idea is alien to the Quran, as I make it clear in the book. But how can we then interpret 434? And how can we reconcile this verse with the rest of the Quran? Some feminists tried to argue for meanings of daraba, which means to hit, and to argue that it means something other than hitting or striking. However, I understand where they're coming from and their attempts to deal with the embarrassment the traditional understanding of 434 brings, I believe staying faithful to what the text literally says is a key to exegetical credibility. Because if we allow ourselves to manipulate the verse or any verse because it says what we don't like to hear, you know, and then we do the same with other verses. So why should we stop with a verse or a set of verses? This is a dangerous route, which on the long run, I believe, brings more harm than good. Now back to the verb itself, wadribuhunna, right? So the verb doesn't appear in the Quran as a root in abstract. It's precisely conjugated, like all verbs in Arabic. And due to its precise conjugation, because it appears like wadribuhunna, so clearly it indicates a command given to a group of men or a mixed group to hit an absent group of women, which is the object here. The verb can't stand for any other meaning other than to hit or to strike, unless followed by a preposition, like daraba an, to ignore, right? But it's not followed by a preposition as well. And therefore, instead of these lexical gymnastics, which are understandable at the end of the day, you know, for sure, I am trying, or I try to listen to the verse itself, let the simple observations lead me through it. For example, the verse doesn't say husbands, rather it says men. The verse doesn't say wives, rather it says women. The addressee, the point you mentioned, Shahnaz, the addressee in the verse are not husbands. The addressee, as we can learn from the preceding and as well as from the following verses, is not husbands, but the community of believers, both men and women. Therefore, and due to 20 arguments, I it's going to be boring if I go over all of these arguments in this interview, I propose that the verse is referring to a command given to the community with recommendations of 3 correctional methods to deal with female violators of law. The recommendations start with reproaching, which stands for today's warning, like court warnings, escalates to imprisonments, which used to take place in bedrooms, and finally can escalate to beating if approved by the local authorities. The verse, in short, has nothing to do with domestic violence, let alone recommending domestic violence. And more importantly, it's not even related to any marital context. And of course, I invite readers to read the 20 arguments, because I go into so many other details. I go in the verse, like I take every word, every expression, and I end up by supporting this new reading via using 20 arguments.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
I think, I wonder if somebody might say, well, why is, and I feel like either in 434 in a different verse, but you kind of address this question. And so I was convinced. But for our readers, how might you respond to the question that why is the Quran only asking for, you know, a communal punishment for women? What do we do with women with men who are recalcitrant or not?
That's a very good question. So in some other verses, we have, for example, as-sariqu was-sariqatu faqta'u aydiyahuma, the thief, male and female, cut their hands, right? So sometimes some punishments were joined both genders together, but here it seems to me that it's more general and it's more addressing women as a delicate social group that if only grouped with others can be wronged. This world belongs to men, right? And let's imagine back then how much it was pretty much the same or even worse. So it's dealing with sensitive groups with extra level of caution, I would say. And it's not alien to the Quran to treat the elderly, orphans, and women as delicate groups that needs to be given extra attention. It matches the core message in the Quran, I would say.
The specific and special references to in particular individual groups, individuals right. or groups, right. it's representative of the vulnerable status of those particular individuals. Okay. So you argue that the Quranic idea that men have a degree of daraja higher than women refers specifically to daraja in the context of financial responsibility in case of divorce. Can you elaborate on this and how do you arrive at this conclusion?
Sure. With the meaning of daraja, again, it's the simple methodology. It's what the text indicates. You know, Shahnaz, with many arguments, I just find myself just following the text. I learned only how to listen and how to listen carefully. For sure, what needs to be done first is to be open to the main idea of thinking out of the box. Second, to have more trust in what we do as modern scholars. Unfortunately, following this tradition that no opinion can be considered sound unless you cite someone from the Salaf probably mm-hmm. affirming it is right. what keeps us behind in terms of understanding the rich context of the Quran. We can be, to the opposite, we can be more faithful to the legacy of the Salaf if we switch from the blind imitation to the active rethinking of the text, as they did. When it comes to the concept of a degree or daraja itself, it starts, the verse itself starts with addressing divorce. And therefore, it can't be general. And here we're quoting from, I'm trying to find it, it's 228, right? The verse starts by saying divorced women must wait for 3 monthly periods before remarrying. So the whole context of the verse is about the financial responsibilities ex-husbands have in cases, and it will go from there. So I just read the beginning. I'm not going to be reading all of it. So it deals with the financial responsibilities ex-husbands have in cases of divorce, which exceeds the ex-wife's responsibilities. And this is a sub-category of qiwama, which is the financial duty of spending. We know, for example, that divorced women have the right to stay in their homes for 3 months. They have the right to financial support for 2 years of their nursing, and they have the right to be supported until they deliver if pregnant. All of these are rewardable duties, financial duties. Observing Muslim men can be rewarded for submitting to. So the daraja here is the extra financial responsibility in case of divorce, as divorce itself, the context itself, the Quranic text itself indicates. And it can't be generalized to indicate gender-based superiority, unfortunately, as many quote the verse to mean.
I think one of the key things that I'm also getting both from this interview and from the book is that contrary to these, you know, very, very academic arguments and very common arguments, the text itself does not speak and that we speak for the text and that the text says what we want it to say. And as you know, we know that's true because we know that historically that's exactly what we have done. We can impose our own ideas onto that. We can project things onto the text. But what you're suggesting is no, the text is clear. And there are especially times when the text is clear, and here are some examples. And if we try to interpret the text outside of these other assumptions and these other expectations and these other interpretations where daraja was, you know, more applicable, and you're suggesting it's no, it's very, very specific in this particular context, and this is what daraja means. I think that's a very, very important argument about, you know, the role that the text itself, that the language of the text is playing in our understanding. So I thank you for that too.
Right. You know, because with patriarchal projections on the text, we moved from merely elaborating, explaining the text into contradicting the text and invalidating the text, right? And therefore, we see so many arguments in the Quran just marginalized, ignored, or even falsified, totally falsified, because the exegetical reproduction of the text was not honest to the text itself, didn't match the text itself.
Right. Let's talk about polygamy. So you argue that there's a distinction between, and you're very clear about this, and I also think very convincing, that there's a distinction between Quranic polygamy and Islamic polygamy. So can you tell our audience, what is this distinction? And also, why is it significant that the verse permitting polygyny, 4:3, mentions orphans? What are you doing that's different from what other feminists have argued in particular?
Now, it might strike one as odd that I'm making a distinction between what I call, and I get criticized for doing that, by the way, before,
really?
Between what is Quranic and what is Islamic, since the Quran is the sacred text of Islam. However, reinvestigating the conditional permissibility of polygamy or polygyny in the Quran contradicts, which is very strict, contradicts the leniency we see in the later judicial application of polygyny, which gradually moved from allowing polygyny under very strict conditions that can't be easily met and can easily be proven to have turned almost impossible in our more modern day world. Polygyny shifted very quickly, thanks to patriarchy, from a strictly conditional permissible solution allowed only for catastrophic community emergency cases, it turned into a recommendation. The hegemony of male-centered interpretations and the absence of female active voices is what explains this development. No wonder if all the proposals were introduced by males, male scholars, or female scholars who, except for a few, had to seek male approval, authoritative validation, and had to avoid criticism, marginalization, and ad hominem attacks by way of repeating male-centered arguments and glorifying patriarchy. The conditional permissibility in 4:3 starts with a conditional if sentence. A very clear a conditional if sentence. The condition is a community fear of leaving behind displaced orphans, which limits the permissibility to mothers of orphans as plausible second wives. Second, the dialogue is again addressed to the community and not to husbands. This leaves no room to personal judgment and leaves the permissibility conditioned by what can be translated today to a court or congregation order. The evaluation of the existence of a realistic fear means that communities that have social security and a system that can allow the state to take care of those displaced orphans won't need even this type of solution. Finally, fairness between wives entails the approval, and I know this is a hard one, many people won't like this, fairness would entail the full approval and blessing of the first wife as a condition according to the verse and according to the Quranic ma'ruf rule of marriage, which I discuss also in the book, as a condition to the continuity of marriage, where women can't be mistreated in marriage. The argument, Shahnaz, is more than I can summarize today. However, regardless of the details, it is sufficient just to mention that what traditionalists usually cite as reasons for the permissibility of polygyny, like most famously men's hypersexuality that can be satisfied with one partner, all these arguments are alien to the Quran, just alien to the Quran. No mention of any of them in the Quran. So they all can be grouped back again to man-made projections.
I always thought it was very convenient that scholars, that male scholars in the past were like, oh, when the Quran says you can have multiple wives, as long as you're just to them, and they defined justice and fairness as, you know, in the very, very limited context of financial maintenance, that as long as you're equally, providing for them, you're all good. And it's like, no, fairness and justice go beyond that as well. Let's talk about Maryam. So you are, who by the way is just one of my most favorite person in the Quran and probably in all of religious history, and such an underrated person too. You argue in support of the idea that Maryam, mother of Isa, mother of Jesus, was a prophet. And the support for your argument goes beyond what we traditionally see by others who believe this too, who've made the similar argument. What are some reasons that led you to conclude that Maryam is a prophet, the Quranic reasons that you use?
Well, in the Quran, I find two different types of evidence I refer to in the book. First is what I call the logical evidence in the Quran, and this includes details driven from her Quranic stories, like witnesses' miracles, speaking to angels, what happened to all other prophets. But in addition, I add a linguistic evidence, and this is based on a new interpretation I provide for 334. Which says the angels said to Mary, Mary, God has chosen you and made you pure and chosen you above all women. Now, back to language again, right, Shahnaz? Rethinking the repetition of the expression has chosen you twice in the same verse, which is not random and can't be random in a text like the Quranic text, believed to be, by Muslims at least, to be a miracle, a literally miracle. Nothing is believed to be random, right? Including but not limited to repetition of words and phrases. So according to a detailed analysis I provide, I argue that Mary was chosen not once, but she was chosen twice. The first time she was chosen, the way all other prophets are chosen. So a high rank, but she shares with other prophets, and we know other prophets are male prophets. The second type of choosing Mary is unique for her now. And this is what is asserted in the verse as well, the second mention of has chosen you. This time, Mary is chosen above all women of all times, of all words. No wonder she's the only woman who will conceive from no male partner. So according to the first type, she's not superior or nor inferior to any of the other prophets. She's equal to them. She's a prophet herself. But the second has chosen you refers to her as the best woman all times, all words.
Yeah, no, that was a really, really, that was very convincing. I found that argument to be the evidence that you gave and your analysis of the evidence was very convincing and very powerful.
Thank you, Shahnaz. And we know Ibn Hazm al-Andalusi argued before for Mary as a prophet, but even though I believe because his view didn't match the consensus of mainstream Islam, it was just marginalized. When it comes to the affirming the prophethood of a woman, including Mary, the mother of Jesus.
Right. So in chapter 4 on female body ownership, I was struck by some of what you say about hijab and the Quranic idea of the hijab and the role that it is supposed to play in a Muslim woman's life and so on. The conversation we had earlier contextualized some of this for me, so I would love it if you can discuss that with our audience as well. But I had some trouble with this chapter, and I wondered if some readers might understand what you're arguing there to be pitting some women against other women, hijabis against non-hijabis, for example. Or if there might be a romanticizing of the idea of the covering of the head. You're very, very careful and you're very clear that the head covering is not all there is to the hijab. And since you speak of the hijab as a way of life, as a message to the outside world, but you imply that the hijab is a solution to certain social problems around us, like women feeling more pressure to look pretty or show more skin and so on. So I wonder if this suggests that hijabi women don't feel such pressure. And you explicitly say that, no, it's not intended to curb harassment, but that there's some minor harm that it can prevent. So I want to talk about this chapter, and I would love for you to contextualize this chapter for us. Walk us through some of your main points, what is inspiring these interpretations, these ideas. What is this minor harm? What role the hijab is supposed to play in a person's life? Why? I mean, is it really generally the headscarf? Why is it gendered and things like that?
Mm-hmm. I like your question, and I like the way you highlighted minor harm, because this is the reason the Quran provides for hijab. It's to avoid adha, right? To avoid adha, which I introduce or interpret as minor harm. Now, a big flaw with the pro-hijab arguments is when hijab is introduced as a protective tool, right? Women should wear hijab to protect themselves and to even shield themselves from men's uncontrollable sexuality. However, this victim-blaming argument, which wrongs women not once but twice by demonizing women for harassment, I see it as nothing but another way patriarchy has manipulated the text. However, contrary to this claim, the Quran, when read in isolation from these views, recommends hijab for Muslim women, recommend them to consider hijab, which translates to modesty, both in appearance and behavior, as one way, not as the only way, as only one way out of other ways to communicate a healthy social message about their seriousness and their high expectations from men around them. Avoiding adha, the Quranic word adha, is not the same as avoiding rape or harassment, because adha, as I prove from analyzing the Quranic term, does not exceed minor harm. It doesn't and can't mean something as serious as those situations. To put it another way, women, by using hijab as a visual image, can send a message, or let's say a social gesture that complements their behavior and complements their verbal communication. This doesn't mean that non-hijabi women are less serious or devout than hijabi women. It only refers to tools that women can use to save time and effort. Because according to the Quran, Muslim women are not expected to be interested or get involved in casual sex or pointless dating. So a visual image can help for sure a woman avoid awkward social situations, being asked out with a man who doesn't value marriage or he's not serious about it. Maybe a woman can be decent with and without hijab. And here, you encouraged me to make it clear, and therefore I don't want to be misunderstood here, claiming that modesty is reduced only to hijab. It's, I would say, it's one Quranic recommendation and advice given to Muslim women if Quranic recommendations are sought here.
And this is one moment where I wonder about the usefulness of relying on the Quran alone for its interpretation. So, for example, your interpretation of the hijab verse is that the Quran's initial audience was already familiar with the idea of head covering, and so it doesn't have to explicitly articulate that, hey, cover your heads. Who is this audience, and what happens when the Quran gets interpreted in other cultural settings where, for example, the head covering is not a normal part of life, or such that covering the head is not necessary or essential or something like that? Or that showing the head, not covering the hair, would count as one of those things that are acceptable to be revealed as the verse.
Right. So if I'm getting your question right, it's where are we getting our criteria from here, right?
Sure. Yes. Yes.
Yeah. Well, for me, and I'm going back to language, maybe this is I lost the count with how many times I'm saying this, but I believe that the Quranic identification is sufficient by itself to prove that women should consider, in a way or another, the way they appear when in public. This is, I take, as a Quranic argument. Also, I take it as independent from the local context of the culture back in the pre-Islamic Arabia. Because when we read, for example, and tell believing women that they should lower their glances, guard their private parts, and not display their charms beyond what is acceptable to reveal. And then the Quran elaborates more by saying they should let their head scarves fall to cover their necklines. The word here used is khimar. وَلْيَضْرِبْنَا بِخُمُورِهِنَّ عَلَى جُيُوبِهِنَّ. The command to use khimar, understood here as a headscarf that needs to be extended to cover the bosoms. I understand a popular line of argument which claims that the command in the verse is to solely cover the bosoms and not to extend the headscarf to cover the bosoms as well. I reject this argument because the verse does not satisfy by saying that the cover should be extended to cover the bosoms. We're not stopping there. The verse adds that women should not display their zina or beauty. And I don't think anyone would seriously argue that women's beauty is restricted to her private parts or her bosoms. Also, the verse mentions guarding private parts. This is also something I mentioned in the book, guarding private parts and not merely covering private parts. And this is a huge difference. And there's a huge difference between both expressions. But there's something else which I take even as more important than this, which is what follows this command is when we read وَلَا يَضْرِبْنَا بِأَرْجُلِهِنَّ لِيُعْلَمَ مَا يُخْفِينَ مِنْ زِينَتِهُنَّ, which can be translated loosely to something like women shouldn't stamp their feet in order to reveal what is covered. Now, I take it as a revolutionary liberation message from the seducer mentality. And this is the core argument here. Because when we speak about a modesty in behavior, modesty in dressing, modesty in everything, it should come from the inside. It's not something just related to the outside. Women can set themselves free only when they stop their internalization of female body objectification. Only when they stop both in behavior and appearance, seeking validation from the outside and from social norms that see nothing valuable in them other than their bodies, their sexual attractiveness, and force on them demanding and unrealistic beauty standards. Here I should maybe also add that by that any discussion on hijab, in fact, shouldn't leave behind affirming hijab as a free choice. Right? Like all other moral and religious obligations, women's bodies should be kept away from these endless battles between forced veiling and forced unveiling. And finally, also I should add that modesty, both in behavior and appearance, was addressed in the Quran first to men, and then it was addressed to women. I hope this clarifies a little bit of your concerns, Shehnaz.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you because there was a giant truck going around my house.
I hope this clarifies a little bit.
Yes,
but of
absolutely.
Course, there's a full chapter in the book about this. So I just tried my best.
You did absolutely. I wanted when we were talking also earlier about we're living in Islamophobia. Let's be real. And this particular chapter, I think, would be helpful to. Especially those non-Muslims who want to understand why a woman might want to cover her hair or, oh my God, this is so oppressive, that kind of stuff. I wondered if other audiences, because I imagine the audience of this book to be so many, beyond Muslims and beyond academics and, it pretty much extends to everyone. And so I wonder if some readers might, interpret particular passages or particular ideas that you're sharing here to suggest something that I'm sure you did not intend. So this is helpful. This is helpful. Thank you. In what forms does female agency appear in the Quran? The last chapter is on female agency. And can you talk to us about the different forms of female agency in the Quran?
This is easy, although I have a full chapter on it, but I can give you a quick answer, Shahnaz. I always tell my students, in the Quran, women are not created from men. They are not created after men. More importantly, they're not created for men. In the eyes of God, women, as I argue in the last chapter, has a full independent political, religious, and economic agency. And of course, the chapter will go into details with these three dimensions.
I when we talk about the creation of humans in some of my classes, my students read the Quran passages on the creation of Adam or the creation of humans, and they always ask, what about Eve? How is she created? And we have so much fun unpacking that question, because I ask them, why are we assuming that Eve is supposedly, she's going to be created separately or differently, or that she comes from Adam's rib, because that's the context they're coming at the text from. So, the various forms of the individual agency, the individuality of the woman in the Quran. Thank you. Is there anything else that you would like to share with us that we haven't discussed or that we didn't get to discuss? Anything you want to elaborate on?
I think I just want to thank you, Shahnaz, for giving me this platform, for this opportunity. And personally, I would like also to thank you for your big project, What Patriarchy, because it's a huge responsibility. So thank you. Thank you, Shahnaz.
I appreciate that. Thank you so much. And thank you for your book. And now before we close, could you tell us what other projects you're working on currently that we can look forward to in the near future?
Yes, sure. Hopefully we can have in future another conversation like this one with a new book. Currently, I'm finalizing a manuscript in which I reinvestigate the story of creation itself. Because in this book, I limited myself, as I made clear in a footnote, to the role Eve played in the story of creation, or the story of disobedience. But I left behind reinvestigating the story itself, which I'm doing in this manuscript, which also deals with the questions concerning the problem of evil, the pain and suffering of children, the pain and suffering of animals, the difference between naming the devil in the Quran as Iblis and Shaitan. It's not the same. Like this book, I adopt the same methodology. I'm finding, like this book, so many new interpretations and new answers deep theological questions like theodicy and the problem of evil. So this is my second project.
It's wonderful. I look forward to it. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Shahnaz.
Okay, so that was my conversation with Abla Hassan about her recent book, Decoding the Egalitarianism of the Quran, Retrieving Lost Voices on Gender, published with Lexington Books in 2020. Thank you for listening, and I will see you again next time.